Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We're going to start with we had at the end of our list on Friday, Martha Brand and Mike Robertson as the part of the public testimony we didn't get to, so we'll start with them. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and we thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. My name is Mike Robertson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Martha Brand and I are co-chairs of Clean Air Minnesota, which is a program of the Minnesota Environmental Initiative, a place where a lot of business folks, environmental groups, government organizations, citizens work on ideas to and collaborate on solutions to environmental problems. We're here to make some brief comments today on one of the change level proposals in the PCA budget. If you recall the presentation from their environmental assistance division, this is the Green Fleets, Green Fuels, Green Energy proposal. They call it Green Cubed, and they are seeking $1.5 million for each year of the biennium, $3 million total for this change level. This is one-time appropriation. And we're here to speak about the part of that that deals with Project Green Fleet, which is a program within our Clean Air Minnesota effort. Clean Air Minnesota was formed 5 years ago when a lot of us were concerned about the state going into non-compliance with federal air quality rules for ozone. And as we have looked at different projects over the years, one of the issues that we discovered was that there are significant emissions from diesel engines, and there are a lot of school buses, and there are a lot of children that are exposed to not very good emissions and air quality around these buses. And so for the last year, we have had a project to retrofit buses that Martha will talk a bit more about. But out of the $3 million that is proposed in the PCA budget, there is $1.4 million proposed for the Green Fleets program. Martha?
So I'm Martha Brand. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I'm the other co-chair with Mike of Clean Air Minnesota. Last Friday, there was an article in the paper about an air alert for Minnesota, and it recommended that children not pursue vigorous exercise outdoors, the kind that, as a mother, you like to send them out to do. And that really just enforced what all people know, and that is that children are particularly susceptible to air pollution. When my kids were little, I used to worry when I put them on the bus about what they might learn that I didn't want them to know at that point. But what I really should have been interested in is their exposure to air pollutants within the school bus. They have been shown to be 5 times higher than out on the road. And so we now know that's a problem. Green Fleets was created to do something about that problem. There are 13,000 school buses in Minnesota, but only about 4,000 of them are in good enough shape and plan to be on the road long enough to make it worth our while to convert. But Green Fleets is out to convert them. Each conversion will reduce the air pollution by between 40% and 90% within the bus. And EPA has shown that the cost-benefit analysis of spending that money to do so is about 14-1 in terms of the health benefits to children. This will be done with no cost to the school district, and we hope to retrofit 300 buses in this year, 2007. We did 200 in 2006, and it's about $2,500 a bus. So it's a great investment.
Madam Chair, one of the great things about this project is that we've been able to leverage private money, public funds from the federal government, and with this infusion from the state, it will really help us accelerate this program of retrofitting these buses. I'd just like to briefly mention the organizations that have contributed thus far to the program, including the Pollution Control Agency, Flint Hills Resources, Minnesota Power, Rochester Public Utilities, XL Energy, Blue Cross and Blue Shield Foundation of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic Foundation, and three regions of the US EPA, along with Washington County. So we hope you can look favorably on the PCA's budget request and help us accelerate the retrofitting of these school buses. We would be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robertson and Ms. Brand. Are there questions? Okay, members will remember this from the agency budget. All right. Thank you so much for
Thank you
very much.
Senator Rummel? We can take you next if you like. You want to go after him? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. First of all, I'd like to introduce an amendment to the 1485. I believe that will be distributed. While we're waiting for the amendment to come around, I'd like to rename this bill the Keep Our Waters Clean Bill. It appears that the naming that got done in the advisor's office led to a lot of confusion last Friday, so we're calling it Keep Our Waters Clean Bill. Second, I'd like to acknowledge the fact that we are very sensitive to the spending limits we apparently are going to be confronted with. So we understand those. The purpose of Senate File 1485, in the absence of a clean water legacy funding bill this year, is simply to draw attention to the value of keeping our waters clean. While the Clean Water Legacy Act is designed to bring Minnesota into compliance with federal law, there is a public expectation that our task is also to keep our waters clean. And I think in the general public, the sensibilities to what Clean Water Legacy Act is all about are pretty vague. They think that besides cleaning up polluted waters, our job is to actually keep waters clean. So this bill does not intend to change the direction of the Clean Water Legacy Act and all the work that the stakeholders have done on that, but instead to draw focus to a small portion, to focus a small portion of our funds on the importance of identifying and protecting waters that are currently clean and keeping them clean. This is an effective way to get us to our goal. Again, we understand the budget is tight. This bill directs funds to the Department of Natural Resources for an expanded biological assessments of Minnesota waters, data collection, and expanding protection of Minnesota's waters. At this point, I'd like to introduce Mr. Landwehr, who can go into more detail about what the bill will accomplish.
Great. Thank you, Senator Rummel. Mr. Landwehr, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the Assistant State Director for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. Appreciate your taking this issue before you today. I also would like to express our appreciation for your consideration of the Clean Water Legacy Act, the recognition that the populace thinks of our natural resources. Waters is one of the most important. Consistently in our polling, clean waters, river streams, wetlands, lakes are highest priority for conservation for the citizens. We believe it's timely that we be looking at these issues, especially given the population expansion we expect over the next couple of decades. Keeping water clean and fixing the impaired waters are going to be critical for the future of the state. As Senator Rummel mentioned, Clean Water Legacy is a great initiative. We fully support it. This is not intended to be a supplement or supplanting of the Clean Water Legacy. We support that initiative as it was passed by G16. But this recognizes that one component of water conservation, and that is the biological end of water conservation. Clean water, especially when we think of lakes, wetlands, and rivers, is really a system, and this is about the biological part of that system. I really want to emphasize that water is not just chemicals and temperatures and suspended solids. It really is the biological entities of these as well. And as an example, I'd like to give a story about ducks in Minnesota. And many of you have probably heard about the plight of ducks in Minnesota. One of the ducks that we appreciate a lot in Minnesota is a scaup, lesser scaup, also called a bluebill. It's not a breeding bird in Minnesota, but it migrates through Minnesota. There's been a persistent concern among hunters over the last 15 years that we're seeing fewer and fewer bluebills in the state during the fall migration. And in fact, the population is declining even while other species of waterfowl are increasing. There's been a lot of effort to find out why that's happening. One of the suggestions that has been made by a researcher who's now with Louisiana State, who used to be in Minnesota, is that as birds are migrating through Minnesota to the boreal forest, which is intact and the breeding habitat is still there, is that as these birds are flying through Minnesota in the spring, they are not picking up the biological resources that they need. In other words, when they fly through Minnesota, they're actually losing weight. One particular researcher by the name of Al Afton identified back in the 1980s that as birds were migrating from Louisiana to Iowa to Minnesota, Manitoba, they gained weight all along the way, all along that route north. But in the early part of the century, 2000s, birds would gain weight up to Iowa, and they would lose weight as they were flying through Minnesota. There was not clear evidence about what was happening there. It could have been the Jenny Craig program for scaup, but we don't think that was the case. I'd note it was impacting, the concern was primarily for hen waterfowl, hen scaup, because as they were getting on the nesting grounds, they were having lower productivity in terms of producing ducklings. One of the pieces of evidence that we have that suggests a possible cause for this is that the birds are feeding, as they're migrating through Minnesota, primarily on small invertebrates, small bugs, cladocerans and amphipods. And we know from other work the Department of Natural Resources has done that many of our waters now are infested with fatheads and other rough fish that are eating the same invertebrates that the scaup are eating. So, in fact, when the scaup are migrating through Minnesota now, many of our wetlands don't have the biological content that they had previously. And this is a potential reason for scaup losing weight as they fly through Minnesota. My point in bringing this whole thing up is not to give you the life history of scaup, but more to point out that the waters of the state of Minnesota are more than just hydrogen, oxygen, suspended solids, nitrogen, and all the other things. They are biological systems, and the animals and the insects that use these waters influence what these waters look like. And the bill before you really helps get at the issue of how to evaluate these waters and how to protect these waters. We have to know, before we can protect aquatic systems, we have to know what's in them in terms of biological elements. We have to know where these important elements occur, what parts of the state they're unique in each part of the state, and how to identify pristine waters. And really, that's what this bill gets at. It looks at doing biological assessments on waters throughout the state. It looks at providing that information to people that use it, decision makers, either in local units of government or with other natural resource agencies. And it helps do some protection on the ground so that landowners who have valuable shorelines, for instance, can maintain those shorelines and continue to provide the biological benefits that they need. So in closing, I can answer any specific questions about the bill, but I really, again, appreciate your support for clean water and appreciate your support for this bill and compliment your efforts on taking care of our resources.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Landward. That was good testimony. Senator Saxhog, please do it again, would you?
That would be the call of the golden eye, also known as a whistler.
Okay, that was very good. Thank you. For the record, yeah. Senator Saxhog's duck call. Can you tell us are you familiar with the recommendations in the governor's budget that relate to these issues in the DNR that relate to biological assessment? I mean, they have something. They definitely have some items in the clean water legacy in ecological services related to, well, I don't remember exactly because I don't have the page in front of me, but related issues and trying to restore clean lakes, which I think you're focusing on in large part, or trying to protect clean lakes, I should say. Is this focus more on assessing and then protecting the resources that are in good shape, or assessing and remediating those that aren't?
Senator Anderson, members of the committee, if I could, this is a little bit of both. It really is getting at the assessment. As the bill is laid out right now, there'll be $250,000 for expanded assessment. That really is to develop a model, which we call Index of Biological Integrity. It's a model that's intended to essentially set up standards that we can identify intact biological systems in waters versus impaired biological systems in waters, to take that database and use that in a public information, system to report that information again to local units of government. So it is both assessment and delivery. Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with the governor's recommendation. I don't know specifically what that allocation was going to be for. But I know that the appropriation as presented is fairly light on assessment.
Okay. Well, I think the budget sheet, that the summary sheet, says $100,000 to increase collection of biological data from lakes. And maybe that's essentially the same as what you're talking about with a larger dollar amount. And I don't know, I suppose we could ask the DNR to respond and tell us which of these items they feel are already covered in there. Is Ms. Van Mueller back there? Thank you. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but just for our information purposes, remind us.
Water activities are being...
Madam Chair, Lee Van Mueller with the Department of Natural Resources. And first, I have to be clear that we're supporting the governor's budget, so this is nothing that's
we just want to know what the recommendations in the governor's budget are, how they compare with this proposal.
Sure. I think a very broad level, we are not, what both PCA and DNR, they work together on the assessment piece, the assessment monitoring piece, and the current governor's rec does not allow us to monitor all the state waters on a 10-year cycle. So presumably some of these dollars could be used to meet that 10-year monitoring goal.
Okay. And then, so the biological assessment of Minnesota's waters, Mr. Landwehr, is that the same thing as the assessment under the Clean Water Legacy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, it is.
Okay. And then the collecting natural resource data and expanding capacity for technical assistance to local units of government. Does that sound... I mean, I know you have technical assistance under ecological services in the Clean Water Legacy. I believe you do.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the way I would interpret that is that it would be dollars for the... to help the entire department actually do the work that leads to the TMDL development. That's where the technical assistance piece really is the monitoring assessment is basically the biological inventory. The technical assistance is really taking what we do and helping work with the other agencies and the local units of government to really do a TMDL.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. Van Mueller. All right. Are there any other questions?
Senator, Madam Chair, we moved an amendment.
I'm sorry. We forgot.
We have to.
Yes, I apologize. Senator Rummel moves the delete all A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Senator Rummel, would you like to move to lay the bill?
Yes.
All right. Senator Rummel moves to lay Senate File 1485 as amended on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Omnibus funding bill, I should say. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
I have another one.
You have another one. That's right. Go ahead, please.
Senate File 1486 is
thanks, Greg.
$2 million per year in heritage and calls for $2 million per year in heritage enhancement funds for developing ecological expertise and managing restoring native habitat. This is above and beyond the governor's budget. The DNR Division of Ecological Services receives only about 5% of the DNR's budget, and yet it performs the most instrumental of its functions, providing a blueprint for making critical decisions to conserve our natural resources. This small group of scientists gathers and interprets and delivers key information that forms the foundation to protect Minnesota's most important lands and waters. This information that is collected guides landowners, local governments, and developers in taking steps to prevent harm to rare plants and animals, lake and stream habitats, and native grasslands and forests. The governor's budget includes $1.6 million a year in heritage enhancement funds for the Division of Ecological Services, otherwise known as the lottery in lieu funds, because it is generated from the tax on lottery tickets. This bill increases that amount by $2 million per year by investing in ecological expertise and in management and restoration of native habitat. And again, Mr. Landwehr can further elaborate on the ecological services function.
Okay, great. Mr. Landwehr.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if we look at the number of wildlife species that are hunted, if we count all ducks as a group, there's roughly 24 species that we hunt. There's roughly 24 species of fish that we angle for. Contrast that 50 species with approximately 1,200 species of vertebrates and invertebrates that are present in the state. Roughly 290 of those species have been identified by the Department of Natural Resources as species in greatest conservation need. That is, species for which we know there are population problems, the population is declining or imperiled, and really need some assistance from the Department of Natural Resources in order to sustain the populations. As I mentioned before, when we think about even the game species like scaup, very often there is some element in their life history, such as the cladocerans, the small amphipods, that are not a species with which we have a lot of information that is critical to the life history of those species that we end up liking. Biologists call this the web of life. Everything is sort of linked together. And we know very little about a very small number of species. We probably know more about ducks than any other group, except perhaps a white-tailed deer. And we know virtually nothing about things like the Blanding's turtle and the tiger salamander and the monarch butterfly. But we do know that they're important in the system. And as such, we believe that the state really needs to spend the money to better understand the native systems that we've got in the state, the natural heritage we've got in the state. As Senator Rummel pointed out, only 5% of the department's budget goes to the Division of Ecological Services, and yet they're responsible for managing approximately 240 of those species of greatest conservation need. So a very small amount of money, a very big task, and frankly, a lot of it right now is just getting baseline information on where these species occur, what their life habitat needs are, what we can do to prevent further population declines. So this bill before you helps us get to that point. Ecological services budget is driven largely by general funds, and along with all the other general fund cuts over the past few years, the Division of Ecological Services has taken a big hit. We need to get some basic expertise within the department, build that expertise up so that we can provide information again to developers, to local units of government, to other resource agencies to ensure that our full suite of natural heritage elements is protected. So this bill will provide for some of that internal expertise within the agency and also to provide some basic funding for landowners who are interested in preserving the natural heritage on their lands. It's a modest request, and again, we request your support on this, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Landwehr. Questions
from the committee?
So.
Oh, Senator Kubley.
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Landwehr. You know, so this is primarily to identify how widespread given species are, regardless of their phylum or whatever you'd call it, I guess. You know, not the phylum, but I forget the word. But you're trying to identify taxonomic species that occupy what areas of this state. You're trying to kind of map where they are located, is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Cooley, this is not the County Biological Survey. The County Biological Survey, which has provided wonderful information for the state, really identifies the range of species, the types of habitats they live in, where they still are remnant. The missing link that we have is that we've got this information, this inventory information, if you will, on where species are. We know that we're having an impact on these species, but we have no way to interpret the information that's provided in those maps and provide the life history understanding that can be used to, again, decision makers decide how and where projects should proceed or how even the Department of the Legislature might allocate funds for future natural resource conservation. So it really is taking sort of the technical information and putting in place an individual, a common sense interpreter to make that information more available to the public.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Landwehr, then so while it's not the survey, you're trying to expand on the information that's provided there.
Madam Chair, Senator Cooley, correct. It's an effort to allow the department to better use the data that they're collecting so that we make better natural resource decisions as a society.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good discussion. Appreciate your being here.
Thank you very much.
Senator Rummel moves that Senate File 1486 be laid on the table and for possible consideration in the omnibus funding bill. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, none. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
All right, we're going to take Senator Couring's bill next, Senate File 1784.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for having this bill heard. I got to tell you, I'm so excited about this bill, it almost takes my breath away, and I actually came in here just to get a bill signed, and I forgot that I had a hearing, so anyway, so it really did take my breath away.
Better be exciting.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Madam Chair, what this is and why I'm excited about this is because there's federal dollars sitting waiting to be activated right now, and all we need is $125,000 to get $600,000 for a project up in my district in the Cuyuna Country State Rec area. And I'm going to turn it right over to Mr. Wagner to explain this. He can explain it, and it's a great project, and I'm really excited about it. And I also want to publicly thank Congressman Oberstar for helping us out on this project too. He's a huge trail advocate, and we sure appreciate the work that he does.
Great,
Mr. Wagner.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time you've given me here today. This is an exciting area. We're really excited about looking at this. I do represent the International Mountain Bicycling Association. I do live in Rosemont, Minnesota. And to get right down to the funding portion that Senator Couring referred to was, the Cuyuna Rec area received a federal grant that totaled about $600,000 in 2005. What we're asking for today is the match portion of that federal funding, the 20% or $125,000. Now, this would be a grand total of $720,000 for this project. If you flip, gave all of you a handout. There is a nonprofit organization, the International Mountain Bicycling Association, that is interested in establishing a trail training center in Crosby or Cuyuna, or in the Cuyuna area, and they're willing to match an additional $125,000 that you'd be willing to fund, and they're also willing to have another $125,000 waiting for any other money that we're able to secure. So we could have basically what amounts to is if you fund this $125,000, we would then could leverage $720,000 in federal and a nonprofit private funding. We feel that this would have a tremendous economic impact on the area. We valued other areas, other trail areas, and we're looking at a net income impact from a financial standpoint of about $1.3 million per year. These were based on 96 figures. We're looking at a trail system that would be basically built for multi-use, multi-seasonal use. It would be used by trail runners. It would be used by hikers, mountain bikers, bird watchers, 48 inches wide, not impacting the area significantly, and we would not have any maintenance costs involved because the maintenance would be taken care of by a group of volunteers. There's about 20 volunteers in the Crosby area right now that are willing to take on the maintenance of this trail. They would be guided by the International Mountain Bicycling Association.
So, Mr. Wagner, this would be a nice flat trail, wouldn't it? Mountain bikers usually like to go up and down mountains and hills and cliffs, don't they?
Yes, we do, Madam Chair.
Good for you. You're talking about sort of a more conventional bike trail or multi-use paved trail?
These would be natural surface trails, Madam Chair, and they would be we would be using the sides of the spoil banks to go up to the top of them in a very interesting way. There would be several different levels of skill levels. There would be beginner for the children who want to learn how to ride off-road. We would have more difficult areas, and then we would have an extremely challenging area as well. That's one of the beauties of this area. It allows us to provide all those levels of trail for the enthusiasts.
And you mentioned the federal dollars. Is there a kind of a deadline, or what's the urgency of getting the state match in order to access that federal money?
The urgency is the federal money as well. It's been sitting there for a while, but it's more for the IMBA portion of it because they're going to only establish 5 of these trail centers in the United States. And what they will be doing with these trail centers is bringing people from all over the world in to learn how to build sustainable trails. What's exceptionally interesting to them in this area is these are soils that have been degraded by mining and so on like that. The environmental impact has been significant in this area, and the economic impact as well. They want to be able to show people throughout the world what can be done in this kind of a situation, using the soils that are there to restore the recreational value and also bringing a positive economic impact to the area. If we don't get this one this year, there are 20 other sites that are waiting in the wings that would like to come in and become one of the designated 5 trail systems, centers. And that's my goal, is to get us one of those right now in Minnesota, 1 of 5 in the nation.
So, Senator Corian, you're aiming for this year's bonding bill?
Madam Chair, I am, and I've been in conversations with Chairman Langseth and making him aware of this, and I believe Mr. Wagner has talked to him,
yes,
if I'm not mistaken. So we're just... We're, like I said, it just takes your breath away. It's so exciting to be able to try to get this project. So we would hopefully ask that the committee would recommend this to pass and send it on to Senator Langseth, if you would, please.
Senator Corian, what we've been doing and what Senator Langseth asked us to do is just write a letter recommending our bonding requests that we ask him to fund. So we would put this on that list.
That would be very nice.
Is there anyone else you have to speak on this?
We don't have anybody else. I don't know if the DNR wants to weigh in, but it's my understanding that they have no objections to this at all. They think it's a great idea, I'm sure. Nobody's jumping up, so I'm guessing I'm correct as usual.
Any questions, Senator Vickerman?
Well, Madam Chair, if you're ready, I'll make the motion to move. We've got a long schedule here today.
Yes, please. Senator Vickerman will move to lay the Senate File 1784 on the table and to have the committee recommend this to Senator Langseth for the bonding bill. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you and thank the entire committee and thank Chairman Vickerman for helping me out. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I could take my bill if he's not. Senator Saxhaug. Tom, why don't you? We're waiting for Senator Wieger, but I can do my bill pretty quickly while we wait. So we keep moving here. And when Wieger comes, I'll tell him. Just hang tight, and he'll be next.
Senator Anderson, Senate File 1282.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is the Hydrogen Development Act, Renewable Hydrogen Development Act of 2007, this bill. And we do have a first engrossment, which you should have in front of you. The bill was heard in the Energy Committee, and we made some minor amendments. And that is what we have in front of us today. And the bill does essentially four things, and there's a handout, which I'll just review quickly, the first page of which explains the key points of what the bill does. I should point out at the beginning that much of what's in this bill already passed the Senate last year, with the exception primarily of the appropriation request, which we're adding this year to try to get some grant money. But what it does is formalize the Minnesota Renewable Hydrogen Initiative within the Department of Commerce and charges the Department of Commerce to lead the way on implementing the state's commitment to developing renewable hydrogen and a renewable hydrogen economy, a hydrogen roadmap. We ask for an appropriation, which will be matched with private investment, to try to develop and demonstrate some of the most innovative and cutting-edge opportunities for demonstrating and deploying hydrogen technology in Minnesota. We require the state to develop recommendations relating to codes and standards. So, for example, you have building codes and other kinds of codes that relate to the use of hydrogen as a fuel source. And I know I'm not supposed to say a fuel source.
It's okay.
Rolf has been trying to train me in hydrogen technology for years, and I'm slowly getting it. And finally, to encourage the state to look at hydrogen in its procurement guidelines and contracts. Rolf Nordstrom is with me. He is really Mr. Hydrogen and has worked in this area for many years. And is the leading person in Minnesota with expertise in the area of developing hydrogen technology and our hydrogen economy in the upper Midwest. So I'd like him to testify, if he could.
Mr. Nordstrom, identify yourself and please begin.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. Mr. Chair and distinguished members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rolf Nordstrom. I direct the Upper Midwest Hydrogen Initiative, which is organized as a kind of public-private partnership under the auspices of the nonprofit Great Plains Institute in Minneapolis. As I think you can see from the handout, the cover sheet there, that little box gives you a sense of who our members are, and the Minnesota members, many of those organizations will be familiar to all of you. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to come before you today to discuss the importance of passing Senate File 1282, the Renewable Hydrogen Development Act. And as Senator Anderson said, she mentioned this bill passing an earlier Senate committee, but it also last week passed unanimously out of the House Energy Finance and Policy Committee with a recommendation to lay it on the table for possible inclusion in that body's omnibus energy finance bill. I don't have – you'll know this better than I, but I think the definite maybe that I got there is because of the budget constraints that you all face this session. So I'm sensitive certainly to that. I'd like to begin my brief remarks by thanking Senator Anderson and the other four members of this committee who are authors on the bill for their vision in seeing that any real comprehensive energy strategy needs to have a mid- and long-term component. And this bill would add just such a component to Minnesota's energy portfolio by including renewable, pollution-free hydrogen right alongside biofuels and renewable electricity. Well, if hydrogen and fuel cells still seem like something out of the Jetsons to you, I'd like you to consider the following. There are at least 15 countries who are investing significantly in an energy future that includes hydrogen and fuel cells. 47 states and the District of Columbia have some level of hydrogen and fuel cell activity going on in them, either tax incentives or encouragement for early deployments of the technology, that sort of thing. There are, believe it or not, at least 72 hydrogen refueling stations across North America. That number includes both ones that are operating now and those that are underway. And that number is over 250 if you look worldwide. So there's that's nothing compared to the thousands of gasoline stations we have, but I think it's more than most people imagine exist. Just California alone has 26 hydrogen refueling stations with plans for 250 and 20,000 hydrogen vehicles on the road by 2015. There are probably, if you look worldwide, somewhere between 400 and 500 hydrogen-powered vehicles on the road, everything from transit buses to forklifts, a great variety of vehicles that have been deployed already, and thousands of fuel cells deployed in buildings, powering everything from banks in Omaha to skyscrapers in Times Square. This year, General Motors is going to be rolling out 100 fuel cell vehicles in California, New York, and Washington, D.C., as what they call the world's largest road test, in an effort to prepare themselves for what they say will be mass introduction of fuel cell vehicles in 2011. They've only moved that date 1 year over the last 5 or 6 years. And both Honda and BMW have announced plans to go to limited production of hydrogen-powered vehicles around the end of the decade, which is not very far away. And while the popular press has devoted most of its attention to hydrogen and fuel cell use in passenger vehicles, there are actually a huge number of niche applications that are really ready for prime time or nearly commercial today. And in fact, in about a week or so, I'll be going to the National Hydrogen Association Conference in San Antonio. And the theme for this year's conference is Hydrogen Here and Now, where people will be able to drive fuel cell vehicles in ride and drives and see the technology that's ready. So these non-passenger vehicle applications, many of them are near a commercialization tipping point where a modest amount of public investment could really make the difference in several niche markets that include things like forklifts, airport vehicles, shuttle buses, ice refinishers, believe it or not, fuel cells for use in emergency or backup power, the kind of thing that might be deployed during Katrina to keep the lights on and give emergency crews power, and even groundskeeping equipment. Members may be surprised to learn that Minnesota-based Toro Company is just finishing building its first four hydrogen fuel cell-powered groundskeeping vehicles, a greens mower, and then a small utility truck. They call it the ant because, like an ant, it can carry many times its own weight. But it's these first three or four vehicles are not being deployed in Minnesota, unfortunately, but in New York State as part of New York's $21 million hydrogen and fuel cell deployment program. They're going to be making hydrogen using electricity from Niagara Falls, produced hydroelectrically, obviously, and then making hydrogen, getting hydrogen from water and using that in a wide range of hydrogen and fuel cell deployments in New York, and Toro's vehicles will be among those deployments. Of course, we wish Toro were deploying those vehicles here. You know, why not mow the golf course, University of Minnesota golf course greens with a hydrogen fuel cell greens mower, or any number of other high visibility locations like the university's new stadium that's coming. So, why hydrogen? Hydrogen represents what many see as the logical conclusion of an energy evolution in which humans have been using progressively energy sources that have progressively less and less carbon in them. We started with coal, we went to oil, then we went to natural gas. All of those things have less and less carbon. And hydrogen has no carbon. So it's seen by many as sort of the logical conclusion of that evolutionary path. We'll just skip the carbon altogether. Particularly in a world that's increasingly concerned about the CO2 emissions from conventional fossil fuels. Minnesota has a strong cluster of companies that make fuel cell components. Nobody that makes the whole fuel cell, but a lot of companies that make the components that go in them, 3M, Integris, Donaldson, ICM Plastics, and others. But Minnesota's comparative advantage is likely to lie not so much in the hardware, but in the ability to produce hydrogen, enormous amounts of hydrogen from all of our renewable energy sources, wind and biomass. Indeed, the University of Minnesota has already developed two different renewable hydrogen production technologies, but to my knowledge, neither of them has yet been scaled up and tested for real commercial use, and that's something that we would hope to change with this bill and this appropriation. Indeed, if you add up the economic potential of renewably produced hydrogen along with wind and biomass, which this body has made a significant new investment in with the Renewable Energy Standard, if you add renewable hydrogen production to biofuels and electricity, energy production in Minnesota could really, I think it's not overstating it, mean a rural renaissance in this state, because all the things that are required are the things that we have, that landowners have in abundance: wind, biomass, ingenuity, water. Xcel Energy is already experimenting with a project in Colorado where they're using wind power, the electricity from wind power, to electrolyze hydrogen from water, storing that hydrogen. So now you've basically found a chemical way of storing wind power, and then using that hydrogen in a combustion engine when the wind is not blowing to produce electricity. So they're going to see, they're trying to improve the round-trip efficiencies of that and see if storing wind power as hydrogen and then using that hydrogen when the wind is not blowing could be a cost-effective way to make get wind beyond 25% even on the grid. And wind is not the only option. A 2005 report by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory estimated that if you took all the residual biomass in Minnesota, wood waste, crop residues, and you converted it using the most efficient conversion technologies, the resulting hydrogen could displace a significant portion of our gasoline use in this state and our electricity production. So much so that they thought it, those numbers justified Minnesota investing more heavily in hydrogen deployments. And hydrogen doesn't just offer Minnesota another clean fuel option. It actually offers the potential for a whole family of industries to grow up here because there's hydrogen production, distribution, and end uses, right? So there are industries all along the value chain there. So what does this bill do? I won't belabor this because Senator Anderson did a very nice job covering this, but the first thing simply formalizes something that's been operating somewhat informally within the Department of Commerce for years, since I left state government, in fact, the Minnesota Renewable Hydrogen Initiative. And members may not remember this, but back in 2003, Minnesota passed a hydrogen goal. We have a hydrogen goal in statute, but nobody really given responsibility for achieving it. So the first part of this bill simply gives that responsibility squarely to the Department of Commerce and asks them to take responsibility for moving the state toward achieving that goal. And while other states are devoting literally millions of dollars to these technologies, our industry members in particular felt that it was really important to have a single point of contact and point of responsibility within the state system for achieving the state's goals. Second, as Senator Anderson mentioned, it asks for a $10 million appropriation, which would be matched by at least an equal amount of private investment run as a competitive program by the Department of Commerce. And the reason that the bill is quite general about how the money would get used is because our members didn't want to end up putting themselves or you in the position of picking technologies. They wanted there to be a competitive process so that the most commercially promising technology options would get funding. I've included in your packet, I'm not going to speak about them in detail today because I know you've got a busy calendar, but there's a one-page set of examples in your packet just to give you a flavor of the kind of project that could benefit from this state investment. And I guess I would say, particularly given the budget environment, that if the appropriation request seems high to you, and perhaps it will end up being too high this year, I'd like you to consider the amount that Minnesota has and is invested in wind and biofuels, its other two main strengths, really. And I wouldn't suggest for a minute that those haven't been great investments. In fact, I think they've been terrific. But Minnesota has underinvested to date in its hydrogen and fuel cell potential. And we would, of course, like to change that. Our members would. Third, the bill doesn't actually require Minnesota to develop codes and standards on these technologies, but simply to figure out how it's going to systematically adopt the codes and standards that are promulgated by other standard-making bodies, both at the international and national level. And the main benefit of this, this passed last year, but the main benefit of this is so that every single town doesn't have to have that same conversation with the fire marshal about whether or not hydrogen is safe and can you really put a fuel cell in a building. There would be some uniform codes and standards at the state level. But we must act now. Everywhere in the world, literally everywhere in the world where these technologies are taking hold, it's the result of a public-private partnership. Without a clear commitment by Minnesota, I think renewable hydrogen and its associated technologies will flourish in other states and regions instead. In fact, Minnesota's own Department of Employment and Economic Development wrote in a recent report, quote, "During the emerging stage of an industry, development is influenced by technological opportunities created by government intervention." And I think Minnesota, that's an unquote. Minnesota's success in ethanol, biodiesel, and wind, I think, offer ample proof. Finally, and I'm on the home stretch, lest you think I'm going too long here, I've given you two maps in that packet. One shows you where the Federal Transit Administration recently awarded projects under its National Fuel Cell Bus Development Program. They had a $49 million program. You'll notice from that map that there's not a single award in the interior of the country. They were all on the coasts. And, of course, we would like to change that as well. The other map simply shows you where those 72 operating and under construction hydrogen refueling stations are. But I think taken together, the maps speak volumes about where capital is flowing today in these industries. And they're flowing, capital is flowing to those states that have a clear vision and a formal commitment to this emerging industry. I really don't think it's exaggeration to say that the combination of sustainably produced biofuels, electricity, and hydrogen could address three of the most pressing problems we face in this century: oil dependence, air pollution, and climate change. Think of the peace dividend alone that hydrogen represents. Unlike oil and coal and natural gas, which unfortunately are unevenly distributed around the world, every state and nation could produce its own hydrogen. It can be produced from many things and with many technologies. And given that Minnesota could be a national leader in our country in renewable hydrogen production, we really must be willing to invest in our state's potential early, as we have for wind, ethanol, and biodiesel. So on behalf of our members, the members of the Upper Midwest Hydrogen Initiative, I urge you to pass Senate File 1282. This is an opportunity to begin making real progress on our existing statutory hydrogen goal. And I thank you very much for your kind attention. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Nordstrom, your appropriations for $10 million?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Could you give us some idea of how much of that's for the hydrogen roadmap and how much is for the grants?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's an excellent question. The legislation doesn't designate, leaves it entirely up to the Department of Commerce how much money to spend on the roadmap and how much to leave for the grants. Actually, in an earlier version of this bill, the first version that our members helped shape, there was a specific amount earmarked for the roadmap. But in later iterations of the bill, it was decided that it was maybe just as well to leave it to the discretion of the Department of Commerce to figure that out. But I think the presumption, obviously, is that the balance of the money, you know, the vast majority of it would be used for this competitive grant program. But we didn't want to give an unfunded mandate to the Department of Commerce.
Okay. Questions of the committee? For the committee?
All right, thank you.
Is there anybody else who wants any testimony, to give any testimony? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And those are good questions we can certainly talk about. How to divide up the money if necessary. I would move that Senate File 1282 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus funding bill.
Motion by Senator Anderson to lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus funding bill. Any discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Senator Anderson. The bill is on the table. And, Senator, will you be next?
Welcome to the committee, Senator Wiener.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. The proposal before you would seek $650,000 for a tunnel to make it safer to go on the Gateway Trail. As you know, the Gateway Trail goes from just near the Capitol here all the way to William O'Brien State Park. A part of that journey is through the North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale area, and the specific proposal here would take you on Highway 36 and 120. Highway 36, by the way, near this site, has the world's largest snowman, if you've seen that, at Margaret, and you go down a bit further at 120, where it's very busy, and to make it safer, this tunnel would provide easier, safer way of getting across. And right now it is dangerous. The Gateway Trail is one of the most heavily used trails in Minnesota, and ultimately this will link with the Munger Trail to Duluth. The time is right. Right now, Highway 36 is looking at major improvements, and that's going to start in just several hours with trucks getting ready for this. And a number of the at-grade crossings have been addressed for safety issues. And if this one is addressed, then it's going to make it even better. So the opportunity is right, and to provide further background on the issue and cite some of the studies that have been done showing the need, I have the city manager for North St. Paul, Wally Weissappel.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senator Wieger has pointed out that this is really the final piece of a puzzle of a tremendously large redevelopment project involving Highway 36, involving the DNR Trail as it goes through North St. Paul, and its involvement by the city as well. Back in 97, through the generosity of this committee, the funding was provided for this study, which really tripped the rest of the puzzle pieces. And what we had was a study that was done. It recommended several crossing improvements, including the one we're talking about today. But along the way, we've made a $26 million investment right now that begins, as Senator Wieger said, in a matter of moments. The highway is being reconstructed. Several at-grade crossings of the Gateway Trail are being improved, going underground and tunneling. And this is the last one that remains. Today, the city has brought to this project almost $3 million. The highway department has brought in about $12 million, and the county has brought $10 million. So this request is the last piece of the puzzle that would complete the project and provide safe crossings through the most urban area of this trail. And we'd be happy to answer any other questions that you have on this, and we're ready to go with it. This would represent the last piece of the puzzle, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Is it cheaper to do a tunnel or a bridge?
The tunnel would be cheaper in this regard because of the complexity of the urban area there. There's many properties that otherwise would have to be purchased. Damages would have to be considered because of visual. The bridge embankments and all would create a visual block to the gas stations and fast food shops that are along that highway intersection.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Weissappel, I'm not familiar with this area. Could you tell us which highway? I know you said, was it
Century Avenue? 36.
Highway 120.
This is at the intersection, Senator, of Highway 36 and Highways 120. The crossing here would just be to the south of Highway 36. It would run parallel with the Highway 36, the Gateway Trail does. And this would be just a little bit, this is at the intersection of 120, Highway 120, which is on the eastern edge of the metropolitan area. It used to be the old Beltline.
Senator Fredrickson, if you go east on 36, you've seen that big giant snowman, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's right past there, right? It's just east of there. And I've crossed
next intersection.
I bike there many times, and there's a traffic light. So you have to cross the highway at the traffic light, but it's scary. You know, it's a highway with, you know, highway speeds that cars are supposed to stop.
And, Madam Chair, do either of you, are there other tunnels on this highway? Is that what I understand?
There are. The ones that's being constructed beginning this summer will be under Margaret Street, which is right by the snowman. And then there are other bridges that cross. And we're recommending a tunnel only because of the grade issues and the sight line issues.
And Madam Chair, do either of you have, do I understand the city and the county and state have participated in some of the other tunnels? But
that is correct. The city and the state highway department have contributed for the tunnel under Margaret Street.
How much will this total project cost?
We're figuring that once everything is completed, it'll be somewhere in the neighborhood of about $850,000. Madam Chair.
And you're asking for, okay, so the other contributions, you mentioned some contributions in the millions, but those are not
that was
this
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, that represents contributions for the entire corridor improvements, which is a one-mile stretch of the highway and the trail that runs through North St. Paul.
Okay. And Senator Wieger, have you looked at trying to do this with bonding?
Madam Chair, it hasn't been formally presented. This would be the first stop, and if there's suggestions on that as well, that would be appreciated.
Well, Senator Wieger, given that we don't have much in the way of a target for spending on new initiatives, it's obviously limited, and obviously the bonding bill is too, but we are preparing a set of recommendations to send to Senator Langseth in support of requests for bonding that we think are good projects, so we could consider putting this on that list. Senator
Frederickson. And Madam Chair, to either of you, is this corridor is under construction now, so timing is of importance, that it would be easier to do or would be prohibitive to do if we delay it a couple years? It would be cheaper and easier now versus maybe sometime in the future much more difficult or maybe not being able to do it all?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, now would be the best time because the construction begins in a matter of weeks here, and it's scheduled. The Highway 36 will be actually closed to traffic for 5 months while the highway is reconstructed, and this would make the most opportune time to get that the trail crossing completed.
And, Madam Chair, have you done the engineering or pre-engineering so that it would be ready to go if you got the money?
We have not done all the engineering. The pre-engineering work is done, yes.
But you could get it done during this construction season this summer?
Yes.
And, Madam Chair, there's no problem for access right away. It's all set.
Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair and Senator Weger, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill forward. This is a trail that my husband and I use all the time, and this is a very bad intersection. We often avoid going down into St. Paul because of this intersection. We go the other way, so I appreciate the idea that we could have a tunnel and get to some of the other places we like to get to in the St. Paul area.
Yeah, and I'm stuck on the St. Paul side, and I'm afraid to go across it to the north. So we need this just so we can see, you know, our whole state. It's a great bike trail,
and so
this really is a roadblock, literally, to making it, successful all the way through. So we'd like to help you. Well, Senator Weger, would you like us to send this to Senator Langseth as a recommendation? Would that be...
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Senator Rummel, would you like to move the bill then?
Yes, thank you. I move Senate File 1248 to be forwarded to...
We'll just lay it on the table.
We'll lay it on the table to be...
Recommend it to Senator Langseth's committee.
Recommend it to the right committee.
For bonding. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Weger. And we'll be sending that recommendation letter very shortly. Senator Dibble, I think, is here. Welcome to the committee. Welcome back to the committee. We miss you, too. Senator Rosen was here the other day.
Oh, yes. I think this is my first visit back to my old committee, Madam Chair. So, committee I was vice chair of under Senator Sams, yes. So, Madam Chair, I'm here to present on Senate File 453, maybe under Senator Saxhog's name. I over chief authorship of that bill from him. Muscled him aside and took over the bill. So, Madam Chair, very quickly, Senate File 453 has to do with shade tree pests. And requests a grant to help control the diseases that are affecting our shade trees in our municipalities around across the entire state. Though I'm a Minneapolis legislator, and folks are very familiar with the Dutch elm disease problem in Minneapolis. This is not a Minneapolis bill. It's come together for the auspices of a statewide coalition of cities, counties, park districts, and nonprofit groups who have recognized that there has been quite a surge in the diseases and pests that affect the shade trees in our cities and parks across the entire state. And not only has there been an increase, but the types of trees and the kinds of pests that we're contending with are growing as well. Recently, oak trees have become the focus of attention. Oak wilt is a new disease, and sudden oak death is another. We, of course, have heard some significant discussion about the emerald ash borer. Madam Chair, that presents a huge threat, and I should add that, of course, not only does ash affect our municipal trees and park trees, but of course our state forests. And if we don't gain control of the emerald ash borer before it gets here, full swing as it has in states to the east of us, our state forests will be a very, very serious threat. Dutch elm disease, as we know, in the early 70s, when the Dutch elm disease first sprang on the scene in Minneapolis and other cities, I should mention the state did provide about $24 million at its peak to help cities deal with that invasion. And as you may be aware, Dutch elm disease is back in full swing and full force. And in 2004, the city of Minneapolis cut down over 10,000 elm trees at a cost of over $10 million. That story is being replicated in city after city. So the need is great. Cities and counties, parks really do need the help. They don't have the wherewithal to really take on the problem. It's estimated that I think there's a blank appropriation. The need, of course, would rival that of the heyday of Dutch elm disease in the early days of the 70s. You know, the need would be $20 to $30 million a year. It's probably unlikely that we would get that in the current budget environment. But just to let folks know, the order of magnitude of the problem is $20 to $30 million. That would be over and above the local effort that cities and counties and park agencies put forward on this problem. Madam Chair, we have a couple of folks who are able to testify to speak more articulately and more expansively to the subject. Thank you.
Senator Dibble, you've got to delete all amendments.
Oh, yes. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
And
I forgot about that.
This is an author's amendment. This is the first committee, right?
Yes.
So let's Senator Saxhog moves the A1 amendment. Author's amendment on that motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails. And we have that in front of us. Senator Dibble.
And Madam Chair, I think the purpose of the delete all amendment, I haven't read it closely, but as I understand it, as described to me, is to make even more clear that this is not a Minneapolis, it's not a Twin Cities urban area bill. This is a statewide bill. We have Jim Herman, who's with the Minneapolis Park Board Forestry Department.
Hey, welcome, Mr. Herman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's very interesting for me to be before you today. It's as though I've come full circle. I started my employ with the Park Board back in 1977, which was the first year of the onslaught of Dutch elm disease in the first go-around. And we lost over 50,000 trees in 2 years, not to mention what was in St. Paul and the rest of the state as a whole. And I guess there's a couple things I would like to be clear about. One is to try and link that past to the future and what we might be facing with the emerald ash borer and the other invasives. Secondly, to reiterate the idea that we're not talking locally here. We're talking about a statewide situation, both in the present and in the future. And then lastly, to really try and link Dutch elm disease oak wilt to the invasives, in particular the emerald ash borer, which seems to be pressing on us with every publication that comes out, I guess, on it. I was responsible back in the 70s for handling the documentation for the money that came from the state. And I can tell you that without those funds, the kind of support that we were able to give to the residents for the city of Minneapolis, and I believe for the other communities as a whole. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, and my colleagues are throughout the state, from a smaller, greater Minnesota to the surrounding suburbs. And I believe categorically we really are one when we start looking at both the need for maintaining control over the Dutch elm disease oak wilt situation and as well trying to lay the groundwork for these invasives that are at our doorstep. The beauty of the shade tree program that was enforced back in the 70s, I believe, was that it had an opportunity for those who were battling Dutch elm disease at their front door to get the funding and the assistance to help with that, and for those who were probably not as much in that situation but still needed to plant shade trees, were able to both apply for the funding. And I think that's something that as we move forward and trying to bring this forward to looking at the Dutch elm of today and the invasives of tomorrow, there's a real need, I think, for looking at that, both the detection and the removal that we're talking about here, but also for the reforestation aspect of it as it relates to all the different communities and all the different sizes of communities that are throughout the state. I believe that there's an importance, too, of looking at what we were able to accomplish with our control funds with Dutch elm disease and oak wilt in the fact that in 5 years where the state shade tree program was in effect from 77 through 81, we were able to reduce our losses to roughly about between 2 and 3% after those first few years. And we're able to control those losses to that level until this recent outbreak in 2004. So there was a lot of local funds that were spent, and I believe the smaller communities, the outstate communities, might not have even had a chance to hire their foresters and to work on developing an urban forestry program had it not been for the funds that were made available through the original Shade Tree program. So I'm hoping that in trying to bring this forward and starting to look at these invasives, I'm also a member of the early readiness plan with the Department of Agriculture, and in sitting in those meetings and also with the Minnesota Landscape and Nursery Association in looking at the potential impact on the trees in the nursery area, the whole reforestation effort, and we're not even getting away from the municipal part and looking at the utilization part, but there's just a real need, I think, to get prepared for what we are going to experience with these different invasives. And I also believe that the EAB, the Emerald Ash Borer, which we've been hearing so much about, is going to have a similarity to Dutch elm disease, but it may also have some differences in that with Minneapolis, we have close to 200,000 ash trees if you're to look at the tree canopy as a whole. And over 40,000 of those trees are on the streets. When you start to look at just the impact of removal of those trees alone, we could be talking over $100 million. I'm sure that the importance of having that inventory on a statewide basis and for each of the communities to begin to look at their areas and to try and develop the plans for that are going to be instrumental in helping us try to stay ahead of these invasives. So I urge the committee to work very strongly, I guess, to look at the appropriation bill and to take that into account. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, we have Mark Stennis, who's a professional in the industry.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Yeah, my name is Mark Stennis. I'm a plant pathologist and an arborist, and I've been in the thick of the struggle with Dutch elm disease since the very beginning, from the time I was a tree inspector in the city of Maplewood in 75, and then as a graduate student in plant pathology at the university working on elm disease. And then since then, in the commercial struggle, I grow trees for people. Managing elm disease and oak wilt has been a big part of my life. But I'm also an early member of the Shade Tree Advisory Committee, and I'm here to submit that the money that the state spent on the Shade Tree program in the 70s and 80s cost a lot less than the money that would have been spent if we hadn't had some vision to authorize inspection, finding the trees, removing the trees, and disposing of the debris. We save trees, and as important as anything else, save money. And lots of money. As an example, for example, of a failure that you might all be able to relate to, if any fair goers here, the situation on the fairgrounds was managed with an iron fist for 25 years. Where we inspected the trees and we identified the trees that had to be removed, and they were removed. The superintendent would often ask me, well, can't we keep it till after the fair? My answer would be, well, sure, if it's okay if that one, and that one gets sick too. So we ruled with an iron fist, and never for 25 years did you see a wilting elm on the fairgrounds at fair time. Well, they decided that they didn't have the money or couldn't afford to inspect their trees and remove the diseased trees and dispose of them, and you see what they got. And you can bet your bottom dollar, that did not save any money by having to cut down every one of them trees and dispose of them, and all that sequestered carbon is gone, and now they've got blank spaces where they have to plant new trees. pardon me. They didn't save money is the bottom line. And what I'm up to here is to assert that resources spent on inspection and removal and prompt disposal saves money and trees and resources. And if you think the Dutch elm disease problem was big, you haven't seen anything yet. There isn't a city in the state of Minnesota that doesn't rely heavily on green ash. My wife and I went for a walk behind my home in New Brighton here this last week, and I looked at it with a new, different light. I've noticed this before. 19 out of 20 trees are ash trees. There was an occasional birch and an occasional silver maple and an occasional Norway maple, barely an indigenous oak tree. But I'm just here to submit that there isn't a city in the state that doesn't rely heavily on green ash. And the more attention we pay to this, the more money we're going to save. It's just an unfortunate reality. It's about oak wilt, too. It's an indigenous disease, and it does damage, but it is entirely manageable with a little bit of vision. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Craig Johnson is here from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I can keep my comments very brief. This is an issue of enough importance that the League actually adopted a separate policy on this issue this summer through our policy adoption process. There aren't a lot of individual issues like this that rise to that level. Our policies, for those of you who looked at them, are generally quite broad. In this case, we have enough cities from across the state, every corner of the state, that realize they are going to be facing these concerns in the very near future, that they chose to make that a priority issue in our policies. There's really no way any community, a large community or a small community, can be prepared when one of these outbreaks of this kind happens in their community. You can't have enough money sitting around to remove every elm tree within a half mile of one infected elm tree. We're going to need state assistance to be ready if these outbreaks happen, and if we want to keep them under control, as these folks with technical expertise tell you we need to do. So very much appreciate your attention to this problem that, unfortunately, we know is coming our way.
All right, thank you very much. Senator Dibble, it looks like you have a blank appropriation. Do you have any? We've heard numbers like $100 million and thrown out there. Is it sort of whatever we can come up with you'll take? Is that the idea? Or do you have a number to recommend to us?
Sure, I would recommend $20 to $30 million, but you know, we'll take what we can. And you know, and I did press the advocates, and you know, they were thinking along the lines of $2 to $3 million, just to be realistic about the circumstances of our budgets. I don't even know if that's realistic, Madam Chair, but you know, the need. I do know that there is a, you know, there was a bonding proposal last year. I'm sure they'll be shaping up a bonding proposal in the coming year as well. That'll be along the order of $20 to $30 million. Of course, the question always in the bonding bill is what's bondable and what's not. Is the inspection portion, you know, some of the work that's done, you know, by the arborists, is that a bondable activity or not? Certainly, the actual removal of trees and replacement of trees is bondable, but because that's, you know, a physical item. The service portion, I think, is the question.
Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just noting, Senator Dibble, that the delete all amendment did include counties and townships, which you didn't have in the original.
Right.
And is there an active mechanism already that includes both of those organizations in the Shade Tree Council, for instance? I wasn't too sure how extensive that is, if it's mostly municipalities or counties and municipalities.
The original state law through the MDA authorizes municipalities and anybody with a governing authority to hire certified tree inspectors to enter private property and mark and condemn diseased trees.
Mr. Johnson.
And Madam Chair, Senator, municipalities in the original bill, because of where it is in statute, refers to counties, cities, and townships. We just clarified the language because some people were not clear on that. We wanted to make sure they understood we were not trying to exempt township and counties from being eligible for these funds.
Thank you, but I commend you for making that clear. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And it's Senator Dibble, as we're talking in the Energy Committee about what to do about global warming and CO2 emissions and how to figure out carbon sequestration. It seems to me that the more trees we can plant and the more healthy trees we can have, certainly that's going to be a piece of the solution for us. So it's really a good, it's good. Well, it's got so many benefits, we know.
Madam Chairman, may I point out one other little virtue of mature trees is that the bulk of the cooling that we get from them is not the shadow but the water that's transpired off the leaves. That's why it's gotten so much hotter where we've lost our shade tree cover.
Really? But I thought you're still supposed to plant them on the west side of your house, right?
Well, yeah. West, and if you're going to plant it on the south, close so that the sun, winter sun shines in. Yeah.
Sure. Well, Madam Chair, I was...
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I was clever enough to anticipate the demise of my poor elm tree out in front of my house on the boulevard and planted a second maple tree out in front, which grew up in time. You know, that was about 15 years ago, grew up in time to throw enough shade to keep my house cool. It faces west. And I'm dismayed to learn that now there are critters that are coming that will kill maple trees. So I'm not sure, but I'm at a loss here. I'm in a quandary. I don't want my maple trees to go where I'm literally cooked.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, we lost the big elm trees around our farm and our farm home about 30 years ago. And that's ironic when we had to get air conditioning. We did not have air conditioning when the big elm trees shaded and provided the moisture evaporation. But we replaced them with ash trees.
Yes. Oh.
So you're going to get cooked before I do, Mr. Senator Fredrickson.
Yeah, we're going to try to prevent that, but... We'll see what we can do to prevent it from happening. It's hard. All right. Well, Senator Dibble, would someone like to move the bill? Senator Fredrickson moves that Senate file 453 as amended be laid on the table for a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion fails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, members. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to hand those things? We should do those now. Senator Chaudhry, I think we'll do. You want to talk about a bill when we talk about the governor's change items, correct? Why don't we take a moment, and we're going to pass out a list that's been prepared by Mr. Mueller. That's a list of all the funding requests in front of this division for members' information, and. As you can see, it's a long list. And the total of general fund requests for the biennium in this bill is $205 million plus dollars. And members, that does not include, there is not a special bill asking for $80 or $100 million for clean water legacy. Okay. That's only what's in the governor's budget. So that's not even included. An increased amount for clean water is not included in this, except for a few individual small bills that relate to individual water projects. And on the back, there are the bills listed that would ask for money from the Game and Fish Fund or other funds. So, as you can see, members, we have a big job ahead of us of trying to come up with a short list of top priorities for our division in the next few days. And we don't have official one-time targets set yet, and so that makes it all the harder, but I'm working on trying to get a number established. So are there any questions about this? Senator Chaudhry.
I would be willing to do my part, Madam Chair, and put my request in the Game and Fish Fund, as the governor has proposed. So you can count on the $205,300,000 less.
Which bill are you talking about? What's
the Roadsides for Wildlife.
What number is it?
1256.
1256 out of general fund.
So Mr. Mueller can do the calculations. You only have about $204 million now that you can...
What was this, $200,000? Well, I think we're rounded down to about $205 million even now, more or less. Under $205 million.
I'm happy to do my part.
Thank you, Senator Chaudhry. That's generous of you. I already took one of my bills off of here that you don't see on here, so just keep that in mind. All right. And we do have a number of bills left that we haven't been able to hear. We're trying to, as you know, members, we've been meeting every moment we could and then some, and so we're trying to
hear. Every room you can, too.
Pardon me?
In every room.
In every
room. And policy and funding on this provision.
So we're doing our best to hear all the proposals that senators would like heard, although we're not going to get to every single bill, but we're doing our very best to hear what are priority items for members of the Senate. So we still have a full agenda. We're scheduled for Thursday, and we'll hear more bills Thursday, and then we also have Friday scheduled. And, you know, if members want to remove their bills from the list to be heard, we can have a shorter meeting on Friday. But so far, we're scheduled to meet then as well. So let's continue. We wanted to hear from the governors. We have someone from Bowser, a bonding change item, Mr. Lines, and then a couple of witnesses who wanted to speak to that. And then Senator Chaudhry, can you explain, you have a bill that represents this request? Is that true?
Madam Chair, I have a bill that relates to this request. It's the governor is going to be talking about a $10 million supplemental bonding appropriation or a change item. And my bill is going to be 15, which reflects the need. But we'll hear about all that.
Okay. I think your bill is in our committee, but it's not on today's agenda. So
Correct.
We can't take action on it today.
Correct.
But for purposes of information, you can certainly talk about it. So Okay. Why don't we take the testimony? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lines.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Kevin Lines. I'm the Conservation Easement Manager for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm here on behalf of the governor, who is recommending a $10 million emergency bonding authority to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to leverage available federal funds in the USDA Wetland Reserve Program and for completing the state's agreement with USDA Farm Service Agency administration under the CREP 2 program. These funds would be specifically used to purchase permanent wetland restoration easements and for restoration activities on approximately 8,500 acres of private land through voluntary conservation easements. The funds would leverage $15 million of USDA, WRP federal funds. The proposal the governor proposes includes $8.5 million for easement acquisition and construction and $1.5 million for technical and professional services provided to the state and our local soil and water conservation districts that we use to deliver our program locally. Specifically, I did have one handout that spoke to the present status of our Rim Reserve Conservation Easement Program. And if, in particular, I think what's noteworthy there is that the bonding that Bowser received in 2005 for the CREP 2 program and conservation easement, we anticipate by June 30th of 07 that we'll have obligated roughly $18.6 million of that appropriation. And that will lead into the emergency that we have here in looking at leveraging additional federal WRP dollars for the state. I might also just remind the group that the Rim Reserve Program is the most successful conservation easement program in the country since the legislature established the program back in 1987. We have taken almost 5,000 conservation easements through voluntary landowner contributions. We've enrolled approximately 190,000 acres in that. In addition, noteworthy, since 1998, we have leveraged over $200 million of federal USDA funds with the Rim Reserve Program, so one of its greatest attributes is the ability to provide additional leveraging opportunities. That's really what we're here to talk about today. Specifically, we have a situation where without this emergency bonding funding, we're going to lose out on an opportunity to use $15 million of WRP funds because of essentially a new appraisal process that has been initiated through the National WRP Program. And I'm going to really let Tim Kohler at this time talk about that. But in essence, what we want to be able to do with this bonding appropriation is looking at collaborating the two programs. The federal WRP program would be looking at taking a 30-year easement on a wetland restoration, and we would be looking at piggybacking a permanent rim reserve easement on top of that. Between the two programs, the landowners would receive a payment that would be attractive enough for them to enroll in a permanent conservation easement. We'd be looking at, obviously, wetland restoration as the priority and the many benefits that we're all aware of from that scenario. So with that, we'll turn to Tim Kohler.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Tim Kohler. I'm the Assistant State Conservationist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Natural Resources Conservation Service. It's a mouthful. Sorry about that. One of my job duties is I primarily manage the U.S. Farm Bill funds that come to Minnesota, roughly in the $50 million a year range for conservation programs. Bill Hunt, our state conservationist, which some of you know and have worked with before, was hoping to be here and had to get called out to a national meeting, so he does apologize for not being here, so I'm here in his stead. As Kevin said, the Wetlands Reserve Program, or WRP for short, is a federally funded restoration easement program where we take either permanent or 30-year easements with willing landowners to restore their wetlands primarily along with associated uplands. We've been focusing the program in Minnesota for many years, over 10 years now. We've gotten many outcome-based type of benefits from the program, including obviously the wildlife habitat and the increase of wildlife species in the state. Reduction in pollution potential from the land itself, increase of flood retention benefits that many of you are well aware of, including also income increases to landowners and local businesses. Right now, we're about the top, one of the top few states in the country with WRP, and we currently have about 70,000 acres on 600 easements. In 2006, as Kevin mentioned, we had a new national policy that a payment process and policy that was put into place that, because of the new policies, really offered landowners less than attractive rates for easements on their property. We were able to utilize the RIM program and tie the two together in the 2006 program, as Kevin has mentioned, as a part of the almost $19 million that has been used already. To secure easements with those landowners. So we were able to keep the money that was allocated in 06 in the state, get priority habitat in place, as well as help with private landowners' easement payments to them, as well as restoration payments. Currently, the current situation, I'll talk to that real quick, we have about a $70 million backlog of voluntary applications from landowners to enter into our program right now. I just received about a couple months ago, a $15 million allocation for WRP for 2007. The challenge is that I have is we have to make commitments for that money by June 1st of this year. What we are afraid of is that without another partnership effort like we have just done with the 06 easements, we're afraid of losing a good percentage of that federal money. And if I don't have those commitments by June 1st, I will have to send it back to Washington, and they will reallocate it to another state. We hope that we can go ahead and, in this emergency time, if you will, use a linkage with RIM, go ahead and leverage our money with the state's money, not lose the $15 million, obviously. And then also what my boss would tell you right now if he was here, we're hoping to get money from other states that don't have partners like the state right now here in Minnesota and get additional funds into the state, which has been basically what we've been kind of told by Washington, knowing the great efforts that we've had with the state already. So Chairman, we're hoping not only to do that, but to also improve and increase the funding even above the $15 million that we currently have for this year.
Madam Chair.
Hey, Mr. Kohler, excuse me. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kohler. So to attract additional monies above the $15 million, would it be necessary for us to appropriate more than $15 million? Would we need to have that money set aside, so to speak, to attract the money from other states?
Senator, Madam Chair, and committee members, we have about a $300 million pot of money nationwide, and it's so it's somewhat unlimited from what I can request and what Bill Hunt can request. So if more money was available from the state, we would ask for more money and could leverage more money, so that would be a true assessment, yes.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Kohler, what would be a realistic upper limit of the amount that the state might receive if we were to appropriate the money.
Mr. Coogan.
Senator, Madam Chair, and committee members, and again, the governor isn't my boss, but the president is. And I would have to realistically look at, I think, the June 1st deadline, and also we do have the $70 million worth of backlog, which is applications on my desk ready to fund. I would have to guess probably in the $15 to $20 million range as a rough guess of what we could probably deal with in the next 3 to 4 month period. I'm trying to be realistic with you for us. Now, one thing with that, Senator, is that because of our funding cycles, how your of course, this is would be bonding money, and I understand it doesn't necessarily tie to your fiscal year, but we will be receiving new money on October 1st. That if there was leftover money from this effort, we could continue to leverage, you know, into our next fiscal year, which starts October 1st. So it's hard for me to guess, but the $15, $20 million range would definitely be something that we think we could grab a hold of and leverage at this point. So,
Madam Chair, Mr. Kohler, so that would be total of. Upper limit would be $20 million. Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, and I'm kind of looking at kind of an annual basis. We've received between $13 and $20 million annually now for the last 6 years, and that's the intention, and that's the plan that we've seen with this program into the future. So I'm probably talking more of an annual, you know, annual kind of basis there. So, you know, depending on how the package was put together, you know, we're expecting to receive somewhere in the neighborhood for this year in addition, as well as for next year. So, yeah, it's be more of an annual fund. So $30 to $40 million in a two-year period could very well be what could be expected to be leveraged.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Kohler,
thank
what you. Do you mean by a $70 million backlog? $70 million in what? In requests for landowners to sign up?
No, what, Madam Chair and committee members, much more than that. We actually have willing landowners who have signed a piece of paper, an application form. We have the paperwork on file, ready to basically be appraised and ready to enter into the program as we speak. So it's not just a list of landowners' names, okay. And we have the maps, the surveys, the, you know, a lot of stuff. The true backlog is probably hundreds of millions of dollars if we actually went out and really, really pushed the program hard.
So whatever amount we got in that ballpark, we were at least 15, 20 million you could use up just because you have
on-hand, on-hand applications, yes. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. And does our bonding get let? I mean, do our bonds, can they get let before July 1st of this year? I mean, can they get out that quickly? You said June 1st or July 1st? It's the fiscal year, right? Did you say June 1st? That the money will expire?
With our program, and again, I'm not sure about your bonding question, Madam Chair, but with our program, if we know the commitment is there from the state, we can actually commit the money into our system by June 1st, and that's when we're supposed to try to commit it. And then on June 1st, we're supposed to be able to ask for more money from all the states that couldn't commit money, and so we'll have that until the end of September. Our fiscal year ends September 30th. So June 1st is kind of the first step. If we don't have this $15 million tied up by then, some other state's going to get it, and then June 1st moves beyond that. So even if the state money wasn't available today, we have the ability to commit it, but we couldn't committed without a pretty firm understanding that the money was there, because we would only be committing a portion of it. So.
And when did you find out that this $15 million was available?
Madam Chair, the $15 million, WRP's $15
million? Yeah, for this year, for this
We received our funding about a month and a half, 2 months ago, roughly. We get our federal fiscal year starts October 1st. If you know, with the election and everything else this year, our budget's been somewhat interesting. So we didn't receive our money on October 1st like we usually do. And so we received it about 2.5 months, right around Christmas time is when we had it ready to obligate and ready to commit. And that's as we've been working with landowners pretty feverishly over the last couple of months to be ready to go ahead and get the money tied up.
Okay. Well, as you know, probably
that's probably the ratio.
Our legislative session started at the beginning of January, and it's now getting to be actually kind of late in the legislative session to be bringing new proposals. So I understand the urgency of what you're talking about, but it would have been nice to see it a month ago. All right, Senator Chaudhry.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lyons, what is the governor's recommendation on this? Is it $10 million or $15 million?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, the governor's recommendation is for $10 million, and that is broken down $8.5 million for easement and construction, $1.5 million for implementation, and that would include Bowser agency costs and our local soil water conservation districts.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Kohler, is $10 million then leverage $15 million? Is that how it works?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, it would leverage obviously a significant portion of the $15 million that WRP is presently allocated. I don't believe it would be a one-to-one match. No, that's not the case.
So we would, more realistically, we would get $10 million for the $10 million.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, correct. That would be approximately a 1.41 leverage.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? I think Mr. Heiniger wanted to testify also.
Thank you.
I'll go up with him too. And
okay, Senator Chaudhry, we have 3 more minutes left. Okay. Then we're going to move on to Senator Kubley's bill and Senator Bach's bill so we can finish the agenda.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ryan Heiniger. I'm the Director of Conservation Programs for Ducks Unlimited in Minnesota, but today I'm here representing a diverse coalition of conservation, environmental, and sporting organizations. Hopefully you received a copy of my testimony. Those organizations include Pheasants Forever, the Nature Conservancy, the Isaac Walton League, the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, Minnesota Deer Hunters, and on. These 11 organizations represent hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who cherish our state's wetlands and our prairie. Our collective members have witnessed firsthand the decline of these areas and the subsequent disappearance of wildlife that depended on them. The opportunity before you today is one that we simply cannot afford to let pass by. By strategically restoring and protecting key habitats, important progress will be made and realized for the state's DNR pheasant plan, the duck plan, the rare and declining species plan entitled Tomorrow's Habitat, as importantly to the wildlife benefits of this type of work. The benefits of wetland and grassland complexes are also well documented for improving water quality, sequestering carbon, storing flood water, providing outdoor education and recreational opportunities. As you just heard from Mr. Kohler, we know that there is a strong demand and a backlog of landowners, Minnesota's farmers, that want to get into this program, but funding is limiting. It is our understanding that $15 million in federal funds are currently available until June. And at that time, if the state cannot provide those resources, that money will go back to Washington. The consequences of returning money back to Washington will not only mean lost opportunities this year, but it will also likely have negative consequences when it comes time for Washington to allocate the resources next year. Conversely, if the state does step up and provide the matching funds, therefore allowing this partnership of RIM and WRP to come together again, Minnesota stands an excellent chance of receiving surplus funds from other states. So, we respectfully request your support for the $15 million in emergency matching funds to make this all possible. A combined investment by the state and the federal government of $30 million will result in likely the restoration of 15,000 acres of wetlands and grasslands to be protected in perpetuity. We all know that land is not getting any cheaper, and the cost of doing business next year will be more than if we had invested today. Think of this as a habitat 401k. The more we invest today, the better off our environment will be tomorrow. On behalf of the coalition, I'd like to thank you for your support and appreciate your consideration of this endeavor. I'd be pleased to take any questions.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Hang on just a second, Senator Vickerman. I just want to get this straight. Now, I think, Senator Chaudhry, I don't know why we didn't have your bill scheduled. I think Mr. Jourovsky's sick, and maybe he didn't realize. Maybe there was a mix-up, and he didn't put it in front of on the agenda today. But do we have to we don't have to. That would just be in our list of bonding recommendations as well, in our letter. So we don't actually have to have a bill in front of us to do that. So maybe we could wrap it up today.
Yeah.
But we only have 30 more seconds. So I apologize for that. But we just have 2 more bills left, and we really want to stay on schedule, members.
The delete everything, Madam Chair, is what is reflecting my my bill for discussion purposes today. Let me just provide some additional backdrop of the emergency of this bill. A few weeks ago, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture announced that there would be no new enrollments allowed for 2007 and 2008 for CRP. This is has a devastating impact on the habitat we've been creating across the state of Minnesota in the U.S. Farm Bill. In addition, he also announced that there would be an early exit allowed out of those enrollees who have been in the program without penalty. So this is a real impact on habitat. And although CRP is not the same as WRP or RIM, they're darn close. And this can serve as an emergency response to what the federal government has done in terms of CRP enrollments. So my bill's got the full $15 million in it. Frankly, from what I'm hearing, if there's going to be additional money in October, we could even consider higher than that. But my bill has got the $15 million that can leverage another $15 million, that's $30 million, into wetland restoration that can additionally serve as a literal and figurative buffer to the CRP problem that we're having.
And Senator Chaudhry, my only concern is that I see that the federal program, I think Mr. Kohler testified about this. I'm sorry, I forgot to ask you this question about that you allow 30-year easements under the WRP program, I think you said, or the RIM Reserve. Anyway, in Minnesota, I mean, we've felt, Senator Vickerman, many of us have felt very, very strongly we want our easements to be permanent easements. So can we make this bonding contingent on them being permanent and still get that federal
Madam
money?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, with regards to how this partnership would work, it would actually consist of the first easement, if you will, would be a 30-year federal WRP easement. On that same piece of ground, the RIM, and therefore the state bonds, would buy out the perpetual right. So it would be one tract, and it would be coupling the two easements. So each easement would end up being in perpetuity.
Okay, I see.
We're also very supportive.
For the record, yeah. Okay, so we'd know that our state dollars were buying us permanent easements and using the federal, making the federal easements permanent as well, more or less. In essence, the easements would become permanent.
Correct.
Be extending the federal.
Good. That's helpful. Well, Senator Chaudhry, would you
Are you doing motions to include it in the letter or just laying over to
it? Well, just we don't even have the bill in front of us, so I just, you know, make a motion to recommend this bill to Senator Langseth.
Fine.
Shall we do that? And let's vote on it, though, to make it official.
Madam Chair, which is this bill?
Okay.
Did you identify it from the
bill's not actually in front of the committee. It's Senate File 1783, so you have the piece of paper in front of
A1.
You.
A1.
It's, but we don't have it on our agenda, so I want to be a little cautious. We're not actually. What? Oh. Well, it's just the language that's in front of us.
Correct.
It's not an official bill. We're not taking action on a bill. We're just making a recommendation that the language that's in this A1 amendment be recommended to Senator Langseth for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is everyone comfortable with voting on that? It's a little bit of an informal motion, but all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Kubley, you need to finish yours and Senator Bach's bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 904 won't take a long time. It's a rather simple bill that seeks to form a geothermal heating and cooling revolving loan fund. It takes a look at municipalities that might have needs to replace heating and cooling systems and thinks that the replacement of heating and cooling systems for local units of government is a very opportune time to avail ourselves of the technology that's available in some of the renewable forms of resources that are out there. Geothermal is just one of those, but it would form that fund within the Department of Commerce and make it available to the municipalities of the state. It does seem to me that there are some conditions on it, but the payback period that's listed in the bill is considerably longer than most municipalities are finding necessary. So I think it would be an easy thing to make those loans and to have the municipality pay us back out of the savings that they found on their energy bills during the duration of the payback time.
Any questions from the committee? The Energy Committee spent some time discussing the policy of this bill as well. And Senator Kubley, do you have any sense of how much money it would take to make this an effective loan fund?
Well, Madam Chair, I had asked for an estimate. It's really not very well known. I think if we're going to do it, we just have to put a certain amount in there and see how it goes. I would suggest that a couple million could be used up fairly quickly. It just depends on the number of municipalities that are aware of it and avail themselves of the loans.
Do you have any idea how much a system would cost, just roughly?
Well, according to the people who manufacture the systems, they run roughly twice what a conventional heating or cooling system would run on the upfront costs. Long term, you save quite a bit more in the running of them, but
I guess that still doesn't give me any kind of
how
much that is, but you've been trying to find that out.
Well it varies with whether we're talking about a municipal building in Duluth would be quite a bit larger than a municipal building in Buffalo Lake. One of them is about the size of a private home, and the other one would be considerably larger. So I'm not sure. I mean, it really runs a wide gamut.
That are associated with. Put this in our bill. Okay, thank you very much, Senator Kubley. Any other questions? Senator Kubley?
Well, I'd move that Senate File 904 be laid on the table and for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill, Madam Chair.
Yeah, just to be more precise. All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for the fact that I haven't been in committee. We've been working pretty feverishly on a tax bill with all of our staff, so we're under the same kind of deadlines in my committee as you are here.
Well, Senator Bach, if you can help us with that tax bill, we'll forgive you.
Well, some of us might, and some of you.
Madam Chair, I think you're probably going to be willing to vote for it, but I don't think everybody in the room will be. Madam Chair, Senate File 407 is a one-time appropriation to the DNR for some renovations at a DNR-owned building up in Ely. The DNR owns the building that the International Wolf Center is housed in. There's one other tenant in the building. It's the U.S. Forest Service. And the U.S. Forest Service is today under construction of a new facility. They're going to be moving out of the state-owned building into their own federally-owned building up in Ely. So what's going to happen is the square footage that the U.S. Forest Service was renting from the state is going to become available, and the other tenant in the building, the International Wolf Center, is willing to enter into a lease agreement and take over that space, but the state needs some money to make the renovations that are required so the space is suitable for the International Wolf Center's occupancy. So this is a one-time appropriation. I have with me Walter Medwig from the International Wolf Center, and let me just say, if any of your committee members have never been there, it's a pretty interesting facility to look at, especially if you have young kids to take there. It's a pretty neat facility. very nice attraction to the community.
Well, Senator Bach, I probably told this story before, but just have to say it again. The one time I was up there, we were on a tour. I think it was with the LCMR probably, or with this funding committee. I don't remember. But anyway, years ago, and they gave us box lunches and sat us down in front of this big window on benches and said, okay, enjoy your lunch. And then it turned out it was the Wolves' lunchtime, too. So we got to watch them eat their roadkill while we had our box lunch sandwiches. So that was very memorable. I'll never forget it.
So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to have
Mr.
Wedwig.
Mr. Medwig.
A few words about the bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Walter Medwig. I'm the Executive Director of the International Wolf Center. I work out of our Twin Cities office, and I appreciate your hearing this bill today. As Senator Bach has indicated, we are seeking $350,000 to renovate the structure with the departure of the Forest Service. Senator Bach has certainly outlined the proposal. Perhaps I'll just fill in some of the details. The building is owned by the state. It's managed by the DNR. The building was built with an appropriation of $1.2 million in 1990. I would also add that the Minnesota chapter of the American Association of Architects has named it one of the 101 most significant architectural structures in the state of Minnesota. Since 1993, it has been occupied by the two tenants, and specifically it was designed not only for the Wolf Center but also designed for the Forest Service's use in issuing permits and housing their staff. The Forest Service is consolidating all of their three different facilities in the Ely area to one structure, which again is located across the street from the Wolf Center. The Wolf Center pays a lease fee to the DNR. It's approximately $26,000. In addition to that, the Wolf Center pays all of the operating costs for operating the facility during the year, about $50,000. If there are major structural issues, the DNR is responsible for those. In the Forest Service leaving, we want to look at altering the facility to make sure that instead of serving two tenants, it's primarily serving one, and we want to address issues regarding admission, information and orientation, program registration, temporary exhibits, as well as visitor rest and services area. The Wolf Center is a private, not-for-profit, a 501c3 organization founded in 1985 by the eminent wolf researcher Dr. L. David Meach. And we operate on a budget of $1.6 million. We raise about $850,000 a year on earned income, and we raise about $750,000 a year through memberships and donations from all across the country and beyond. The majority of our members, however, of our 10,000 members, are in Minnesota. And perhaps to reiterate, we do not receive state or federal funding to operate. Visitors from all 50 states and some 38 countries have visited our facility. And the Wolf Center and the relationship with the DNR, has been a unique partnership that we believe has generated good benefits that would otherwise be impossible for us to do without this partnership. In 1996, the University of Minnesota conducted an economic impact study. It suggested that the Wolf Center generates about over $3 million a year in benefits to the Ely area economy. That also includes about 55 jobs annually. The 13 years that we have been open to the public, that has generated about $43 million in economic benefit to the area in $96. Since 93, the Wolf Center has become a strong part of the Ely experience, and we get about 40,000 to 45,000 visitors a year. The center provides critical information regarding the wolf's removal from the endangered species list and the subsequent change to wolf management by the state of Minnesota. And if you saw the press coverage yesterday, the official passing of the baton from the federal government to the state after some 34 years of federal protection happened yesterday. So again, officially yesterday, the state of Minnesota is managing the state's wolf population, likewise in Michigan, likewise in Wisconsin. Minnesota has the largest population of wolves in the contiguous United States, about 3,200 animals. And again, it's a remarkable coexistence with humans that has occurred since, again, their recovery. Why now? The Forest Service, again, is moving out at the end of this year. We were unsuccessful last year in getting into the bonding bill, hence coming back this year. The space is valuable for us. It can be used to enhance the visitor experience, enhance our educational services to the public, and also, again, help us generate additional funding that is critical to our operating not only the facility but the organization. I would simply conclude with that I think this is a unique public-private partnership. It does provide significant educational public benefits and certainly is a key to the ecotourism industry that Ely certainly depends on. I appreciate your attention and would welcome any questions that you may have about this project.
Mr. Medwick, how long will your lease be on the building?
The lease that we have with the department is a renewable lease that renews every 3 years. However, the lease language is such that there is also a perpetual component to it. So it covers both a perpetual relationship, but one that is revisited every 3 years.
What do you mean by a perpetual? Is there an obligation to a perpetual relationship?
The lease is structured such that it is the preface to it is structured that the building and relationship to the organization is to serve the purposes of the organization in perpetuity in its wolf education efforts.
Okay. Well, that sounds like an kind of an obligation to the DNR, to the owner of the building, to an extent. My question really is, you know, if we're going to use public dollars to fix the building up for your purposes, for the purposes of the Wolf Center, then we need to know that it's going to be used for that purpose for a long time so that we know that we'll get our money's, the public will get their money's worth from the change, from the redesign of the building. So, you know, I would have thought we were talking about a 20-year, 30-year lease or something like that.
Well, I'm not sure of the reasoning behind it. The state may be required to do this in a term basis by statute. In other words, the DNR may be prohibited from providing a lease with an agent like the Wolf Center that goes beyond what the lease currently is. And again, I can't say that for fact, but it's my assumption that the state must operate in that basis with the basic understanding, the basic premise is that we would be operating the facility in perpetuity.
And maybe I could ask if staff could just check on our bonding, because I think we have a lot of precedent in the area of bonding where the state or a public building is rehabbed or built, and then it's used by a private nonprofit. But I'm not sure what the relationship is there, the kind of the commitment. Just so we know, there's a commitment to justify the expenditure. I really support the work that you do, and I think it's you know, something unique about Minnesota. You can't see this anywhere else. But we just want to make sure we're getting value for our public dollar. Senator Frederson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Medwick, would you anticipate paying a larger rental fee then, a rental charge for the additional space?
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, we would our lease fee is based on square footage. So as our square footage increases, our lease to the state of Minnesota would increase. Our lease fees to the state would increase.
And Senator Bach, I think you have a very strong case for doing this because it's a state-owned building, and one of the tenants is moving out. I'm a little surprised that there isn't a program in the Department of Administration to rehab the empty space so it can be rented to another agency.
Yeah.
And I think this is a strong case for bonding also. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it doesn't even have to be as a line item, just as, you know, one of the general categories of repair and rehabilitation of state buildings. I certainly will be an advocate for it, for doing that.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, I appreciate that. Mr. Megwood maybe can refresh my memory of how many square feet the U.S. Forest Service has
Their footprint is about 1,000 square feet.
And the Wolf Center is?
Of the existing building.
And then, Senator Frederson, were you done?
Yeah.
Just tell us also, Mr. Medwig, I mean, what additional value will the state get from this? Will the visitors get? Do you expect to have increased visitorship, more programs with this additional space that you have, and the better design?
Well, certainly one of the things that we want to do, again, is just make sure that the visitor flow. One of the things that about this building and about this relationship I think is unique. I think the state in the 1990s started out fairly cautious about entering this, and I think I remember hearing, is if they build it, will they come? And I think over the last 17 years, we've been able to demonstrate that there has really been a strong public response to our programs, to the facility, to our exhibits, et cetera, et cetera. Through the funding, if we are successful, we would provide not only a more museum quality entrance, we would also provide visitor services such as places for people to rest. We would likely expand our retail space as well. As I indicated, we have to raise about $1.6 million every year to pay all of the expenses of our organization. And so part of that comes from admissions, membership donations, but also we have a store that sells Wolf-related products, books, videos, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things that we would hope to do in this is to look at the footprint of our retail operation, which has the potential to expand, which would help us generate additional earned income.
Any other questions? All right.
Well, Madam Chair, it is kind of critical in that when you come in the main door, the building right now is designed to serve two tenants. So there's like two reception desks. And for a traffic flow purpose, Mr. Medwig is right, it needs to be designed so that when you come in the front door, it's not only going to serve one tenant, and that requires some renovations.
Madam Chair, I would move that this bill be forwarded by letter to the bonding committee with a recommendation that it be funded with bonding.
All right. Senator Bach, would you be all right with that?
Well, Madam Chair, the Forest Service is going to be out of the building in September or October. So we would like to, shortly on the heels of that, be able to start the renovations and get the Wolf Center into the rest of the building. It probably doesn't fit very well in next year's bonding bill. I don't know that it's an emergency issue for this year, but my preference would be if this committee had any cash that we did it that way. And I guess we probably don't have an answer to that yet. But
well, Madam Chair,
Senator Frederickson,
we have some one-time money here, I assume, and also I know Senator Langseth has been talking about a certain amount of one-time cash money also.
Correct.
So it could fit either way.
Yeah, we can certainly send a recommendation to him and then see what happens with our targets. All right. Great. Senator Frederickson then moves to lay the bill on the table and recommend it to Senator Langseth for inclusion in the bonding bill. On that motion, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you for today.
Thank you.